Guy Garvey is probably best known for fronting that band, English alternative rock band Elbow. He formed them while he was still at school in the early 90s. His songwriting is revered. That song, One Day Like This, is from the 2008 album, The Seldom Seen Kid, which was a breakthrough for the band. Garvey's also a music producer, he's a solo artist, and he presents a show on BBC Six Music, thus as a supporter and a mentor of fellow musicians. Meanwhile, Elbow's eighth and latest album, Giants of All Sizes, is doing well. He will be here with Elbow for a show in Auckland in June, along with Jessica Hoop, actually. I asked him if he minded having to play One Day Like This at every damn concert.
I don't mind at all.
Because you said, I think, that you had to be prepared to play it for the rest of your career and hear it at weddings because it's so cheerful.
Oh, yeah, this is it, exactly. We didn't know the wedding thing would happen, but no, it's all good.
When people play it at weddings, do you get any kind of royalty from that?
You'd have to ask my manager. I'm hoping that if it was a certain weddings, yes. And if it was other weddings, no.
All right, you've got a short list of weddings that you want money from. It's surprising. I mean, it's not surprising that it's so beloved, but it's surprising that you wrote it at all, because you're not a big happy music person in general, are you?
Would I describe our music as happy? There's a note of hope in every song, I like to think. But I like to think we deal with life in our songs. What I write lyrically is always a reaction to the music that we've made. So I suppose it depends on everybody's mood, really. We were certainly in good spirits when we wrote that one.
Does the music always come first and then you write the lyrics?
More often than not. And we write separately and we write together musically in different combinations of the four of us. One of the great thrills of my being the lyricist in the band is I get these amazing compositions in my headphones to walk around with and think about, react to. So that's generally how we make it.
I mean, you are regarded as one of the great lyricists. In fact, you have been, I don't know, maybe you still are, visiting professor of creative writing at the Metropolitan University, the Writing School.
It's a very grand title, isn't it?
It is a grand title.
All it really involves is me telling students that have come to Manchester to study creative writing that they are already the people they want to be and that they're in a great city for doing what they're doing. I get to gently encourage people, young people, which is just great. I mean, most of them, after a lecture, will line up and ask for autographs and photographs for their parents. Well, that's okay by me.
And they pay you for that?
No.
Don't they?
They'll pay my train fare. It's very, very much a way of... I live in South London now, so it's one of the many ways I find of an excuse to go home for a couple of days. And Manchester was really, really good to Elbow. The city supports its musicians and its musicians support its musicians. So it's a lovely thing to be a part of.
I mean, Manchester's produced a whole bunch of important people, Joy Division and New Order and the Smiths and Oasis and yourselves. How does Manchester support its musicians?
Well, the example that sprang to mind was when we had our first EP out and it started getting some national attention. The band Doves, who are now very old friends of ours, and I've collaborated on many of their records and vice versa, but they were local heroes of ours. They just started talking us up. They started telling people to look out for us. And they took us on our first UK tour, supporting them, and they took us on our first US tour. And then in smaller but still very significant ways, Manny, the bass player from the Stone Roses, who was very much a hero of ours, made a great show of bowing down to our bass player, Pete, when he saw him in a bar once. A very public sort of doff. And, yeah, just those little things make an enormous difference when you're trying to get established. And Johnny Marr is actually, he's given out so many guitars to young Manchester bands, and it's not something he shouts about, so it's something I make sure I shout about. But yeah, Johnny's passed on his very valuable and beloved guitars as a way of supporting musicians coming through for many years now, and that kind of thing, really.
That first EP that you mentioned, John Peel gave it a big boost, what, 1998? And in a way, yeah, you've got a John Peel role now, haven't you? Because your radio show, for starters, sets off a lot of careers.
I do as much as I possibly can, yeah. I mean, you've got to bear in mind, Kim, that it makes me look cool as well, you know, to be abreast of the next best thing. And that's not the right phrase. The next big thing is the phrase, isn't it? And yes, I mean, I do as much as I can because I love being around it. I love being around the energy. And I remember what it felt like first getting a record together and first getting established and finding fans. And yeah, it's still a huge thrill to go all around the world and to find our audience. Well, I mean, when we come to see you guys, we're as far from home as we can be without leaving the planet. And there's really no fiscal reason for coming all that way. You know, it doesn't make any financial sense. It's just we have fans there and we want to see them.
I was surprised to hear that you had so many fans in Mexico. I mean, I don't know why.
Well,
I'm surprised. Hey?
Yeah. We were surprised as well and delighted. We played in Mexico City recently, and a couple of thousand people singing our words back to us was really amazing. And it's one of our favourite parts of the job, really.
Did Jessica Hoop open for you, that one?
She wasn't in Mexico, but she came to the rest of the gigs we did in California.
She's amazingly good, Jessica Hoop.
Oh, she's incredible. And that's another thing the radio show's given me. I first met Jessica interviewing her for my program, and then she came on tour with us in the States and fell in love with my tour manager and moved to Manchester. We kind of stole her from California.
Really?
And she is, yeah. And she is one of our best songwriter. She's amazing.
That song Memories Are Now is just...
Sorry?
The song Memories Are Now is just the best feminist anthem ever, isn't it?
She's an amazing woman. What can I say? Every time she puts a record together, it blows my mind. You can never tell what she's going to do. She's a true artist. And the way she presents her music as well, you go to see her and she might have seven people on stage with her, she might be on her own, and just the way she morphs to the space she's playing in and the way she talks to the crowd, she's amazing.
Rock music, I mean, generally speaking, excuse the stereotype, is not known for blokes being generous and supportive of women, but you are. I mean, you, Jolie Holland and Laura Marling, they're all, you know, praised by you. Do you make a point of this?
No, I think I love female singers. I love female lyricists. It's not somewhere I can go with my own songwriting. And therefore, it holds the same mystique for me that it always has. It's a different perspective on the world from the very outset. And therefore, it's still shrouded in mystery. When I hear a great woman lyricist talking from a perspective that I'll never have, then, of course, it's a bottomless well of amazing emotion.
You toured with John Grant as well, talking about different perspectives, who's also fabulous. How did you meet him?
now then. So
because he's on Kindling in on Little Fictions, isn't he? Does he joins you on Kindling?
Yes. Yeah, we rewrote the song to include John after the album was out. It struck us that it could be a duet, and then Craig had the idea of duetting with John, and then writing for his voice was easy because I know what I love about his voice and I know what I love about his music. And the fact that he was up for doing it was something which we're very, very proud. John's a great artist. And again, somebody who really prides himself in supporting other artists, not just musicians, comedians and filmmakers. He's an incredibly sweet man and just one of the great facilitators.
Jessica Hoop then moved for love, as did you.
I certainly did. for years and years, when I got into a taxi in Manchester, the drivers would say things like, "You boys have never moved to London, have you? You know, not like those Gallaghers. You know, like we all live on the same street, you know." And I have to admit to saying, "Why would I move to London? What's London got that Manchester hasn't?" And then I met Rachel, and Rachel wasn't moving from London. And yes, I moved for love. I get it in the neck when I get into a taxi in Manchester now.
And your mother-in-law is, I was about to say Emma Peel, that shows how old I am, Dame Diana Rigg.
Yeah.
That's pretty special.
She's wonderful, yeah. She's the coolest mother-in-law I think anyone's got. And she's a great granny as well to our son, Jack. But I love Diana very much. We have a hoot whenever we see each other. She's very much about words, Diana. And whenever we meet, she's got a small notebook of things to tell me, phrases or words that she's heard that she hasn't heard before. And the other thing that we love to do is I've got a pretty encyclopedic knowledge of classic tunes. So she'll throw me a couple of lines, and she's always really impressed when I know the next two. And, yeah, we quite often, over Christmas, we had a lot of cold porter going on. And she's just great. She's just an amazing woman. She's fearsome and fearless and endlessly fun and a very wonderful, warm person. And just in terms of her work ethic, my wife has inherited her attitude to work, which is she lives for it and she loves it, but she will not take herself too seriously or let anyone else take herself too seriously. One of my wife's favourite phrases when she joins a new cast for a play is, "Darling, it's not called a serious, it's called a play." She, to give you an example of how important my wife is to me, some of the material on the new album is very sensitive. It's to do with my dad passing away. And at the end of the tour we were just talking about in California, I was doing a session for KCRW, and for the first time in introducing a song about my dad, I was overcome with emotion and I had to leave the studio. Never happened to me before in all the years I've been doing it. And it's because I was very, very tired. And also, the song in question, Weightless, is about my son as well as my dad, and I was missing them both that day. And I phoned my wife to tell her that I'd just had a bit of an episode, and she said, "Grow a pair of ovaries."
Oh, grow a pair of ovaries.
Yeah.
No.
So this is, yeah. My many sisters have always been the strong women in my life.
Five sisters all older than you.
Yes.
Crikey, I wonder if that's responsible for you valuing women's perspectives so much.
Well, they introduced me to all the music that I grew up with and how to listen to it. They gave me my worldview between them and my mum and my dad. And also, in the case of my eldest sister, Gina, she's literally given me lyrics that make song all the time. Her economy with language is amazing. She's an NHS worker and has been her whole life. And she has to be witty on the fly, you know, in a busy ward. She has to get her bon mots across at 100 miles an hour to a colleague on a passing trolley. So her economy of language is amazing, you know, her way of describing things.
Lest we don't mention it, your wife, Rachel Sterling, is well known to people who might have seen The Bletchley Code or The Detectorists, Tipping the Velvet. She's very busy.
Yeah. Yeah. Theatre at the moment, she's just about to open in Love, 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 which she's adoring. It's funny, you know, it's, since we've had Jack, so the last 3 years, we've had to be really, you know, planning quite far ahead in how we divide childcare, how we make sure that we both get to work. But at the moment, she's leaving in the morning, her very most glowing self, rehearsing for a play she's excited about. And at the same time, I'm getting ready to come out and see you guys. So it's a wonderful thing to be a part of.
So you didn't have a midlife crisis, you had a midlife settling down.
Yeah, it's not fair really, is it? I've got my favourite job and, my two favourite jobs between my radio broadcast and the band. I've got my two dream jobs and I have a woman that supports me and that I get to talk to. I mean, talking about perspectives, Rachel's from such a different background. I'm from a poor working class background of self-bettering socialists, self-educating socialists, and her father is landed gentry in Scotland and her mum is British acting meritocracy, and we have so much to discuss from the previous 40 years to when we met, but I think it should keep us going till the end of days.
And also, you come from that big family. I think she's the only child. So that's a really interesting difference, don't you think?
Well, she's got three beloved half-brothers, two older and one younger.
Right.
You know, she's round there tonight, actually, her and Jack around at her brother Ludo's. But yes, in terms of our life experience up until meeting each other, vastly different. And her insights into her profession resonate all the time with what I do and what I want to do. It's I am literally the luckiest man I know.
Your latest album, Giants of All Sizes, is pretty personal. It's very political. You mentioned Wakeless, which refers to your father who died, I think, while you were making the album. You obviously loved him very much, but did you have to mend bridges at the end, as people often do with their parents?
I'm lucky in that I did all the repairing with Dad sometime earlier. Like, we were very good friends for 15 years before he died. It actually started by accident, and not to get too Dr. Phil about it, I was dating a girl who lived in California and we were on the phone all the time, and every phone call ended with "I love you." And then one night I accidentally told my dad and he stumbled. And then the next time, because the world hadn't caved in and the walls hadn't fallen down, the next time I spoke to him, I did it deliberately. And he said, "You too, son." And to cut a long story short, he was very much a man of his generation. You know, he was a war baby and a man's man. And his father, very much absent from his upbringing, due to being in the army. And the very, very simple thing of telling one another that we loved each other was all that we needed to do. And for the last 15 years of his life, whenever we ended a phone call, I'd say, "I love you, Dad, I'm proud of you." And he'd say, "I love you, son, I'm proud of you." And that is literally all you need to know. And the amount of, as particularly in the working class north of England, the amount of friends I have that have trouble saying that, even knowing their fathers were going to die. And such a simple hurdle to get over, and such an enormous thing, really, to both parties. Just a really, really simple fix for any dads and lads trauma.
Good advice. How did you learn that? I mean, with the father you had, how did you learn to go there?
Like I say, the first time it was an accident. Maybe it may even have been a little bit combative the second time I did it. Maybe I was trying to make him uncomfortable. But in no time at all, it became really important to both of us. The other thing was he was proud of me. Nobody in my family had done anything in the arts, aside from a great-great-grandfather on my mum's side. He was a tattoo artist. Nobody in my family had done anything other than very manual labour, or there was a lot of teachers, a lot of policemen, a lot of nurses, a lot of public service. But nobody had done anything in the arts before me and my brother. And it was difficult for him to marry the idea of me doing something like that and being a responsible man. But when we succeeded, he was enormously proud of me. And, you know, I suppose I could have been churlish at that point, and I could have said, why haven't you been proud of me all the years we've been trying? But I was just really, really glad of his pride, and it forged a relationship. The other thing is, he was a really lovely bloke. I hate to paint a picture of him as, you know, he found it difficult expressing his emotions, but that's generational, I think. He was a really, really lovely bloke, and a very clever fellow as well.
You're a father now. That's made all the difference, hasn't it? It does make all the difference to how one sees one's life, yeah, and one's relationship with one's parents.
Yeah, absolutely. And Dad and Jack met twice. And I remember him holding Jack up as a baby and studying his face. I mean, Dad didn't know he was poorly at that time, but he was. I remember watching him in genuine awe and delight studying my son's face, and my son's named after his big brother. And the only time I ever saw my dad look like a little boy was in the company of his big brother, Jack. Mm. So I knew it was a big thing for Dad that I named my son for him. And I could see while he was searching his face, he was looking for things he recognised. You know, my dad was so enormously proud of his family. And he died surrounded by them. My eldest sister that I mentioned earlier, Gina, nursed my father to his death in her house, which is a debt none of us will ever be able to repay. And he was surrounded by people telling him stories, singing him songs, telling him jokes. He never felt any pain, which nobody should do in this day and age. And he had the best possible end somebody could. And he said in his last 2 weeks that he'd never felt more loved in his entire life. And he couldn't have been more beautiful. And Jack's coming along made Dad's passing part of things as opposed to the end of something.
Yeah, yeah.
And it also made me part of something important, but not the most important part of something.
Part of something, but not the point of it all.
Exactly.
Look, it's been very good to talk to you, and we are looking forward to seeing you and Jessica Hoop in Auckland in June.
Thanks, Kim.
I want you to...
Can't wait.
I want you to choose a track to go out on from your latest album. We've talked about Weightless. Would that be your choice?
Yeah, I guess, as we've been talking about it, absolutely. Very, very simply, this song is To My Son, about my dad.
Weightless. From Elbow's latest album, Giants of All Sizes, I was talking to Guy Garvey, and Elbow are coming to Auckland, along with Jessica Hoop, in June.